Good to be back home again. For those of you who don't know us, we grew up in this church. And I was one of the little kids who used to sit down the front. Now, we didn't used to sit down the front, we used to sit around, you know, facing each other. And my dad would do everything he could to keep me quiet, including giving me maths problems to work out during the service. But it's good to be back, and we know many of you, good friends, long time, people here, a whole lifetime. And I can't believe it was 40 years ago that Jenny started the playgroup here. My goodness, how old are we? It's an interesting passage that I was given, and the passage was given to me with this topic, responding to opposition. I haven't got the clicker. Responding to opposition. So I sort of expanded that topic to representing Jesus in a post-Christian society. You know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, we couldn't really say we were facing a lot of opposition. Go further back, probably not much at all. Actually, we were in favour. And I'm going to talk about that. So how have things changed? And what relevance does this passage have to us today? Here's these people, God's people. They're trying to achieve God's ends. And they've come up against opposition. They're ridiculed, they're despised, and then they're attacked because they started to be more prominent, more successful. Is there parallels today? I think there is. If you're Christian today, in a post-Christian society, in Western society, or in a developed world context, things have changed, particularly for the institutional church. We've been gone from being favourable to having a place in society, to a place of ambivalence, don't really care, you're Christians, the church, you know, to now actually opposition and open hostility. There's 2.8 billion people in the world who still identify as Christian, whether they're genuine followers of Jesus. There's still a lot of people, about a third of the world's population. In Australia, the numbers are diminishing, and our influence is diminishing. And we can learn some things from the story, but I don't want to do a deep dive into the actual story. What I want to do is bring parallels to that story and how do you respond to opposition? One of the things we can learn from that story is, though, you don't withdraw. You don't give up. You don't walk away from the wall. You don't walk away from the job of building what God has asked us to build. And as you do that, you're going to encounter more opposition. And we are seeing that in our society today. So this is what they copped, the Jewish people. What does this bunch of poor, feeble Jews think they're doing? What do these Christians think they're doing? Do they still think they're relevant? Do they have a voice in our society? Actually, no. We don't think they're relevant. In fact, we don't only don't think they're relevant, we think we've got to fight against them. We've got to disqualify them from having a place in our society. Do they think they can build a wall in a single day just by offering a few sacrifices? Do they think they can do anything following an imaginary God, I've heard said to me? Your imaginary friend. One of my people I was talking to about how they responded when they said they prayed. Oh, you're praying to your imaginary friend, that Jesus. So this is the sort of thing that we read about in Nehemiah, but it's something we've got to actually work out. What does that mean to us today? How do we relate to this today? What's changed in our world? What happened to our world? And as we look at Christianity, as we look at Christianity's place in our society, in our societies that we find ourselves in, a Christian society, Christian countries, countries that were built on a Christian heritage, what has happened over the last few years to bring us to this place? There's various sociologists you can go to who have a bit of understanding of this. One in particular, Aaron Wren. I've read a lot of his stuff recently, just to try and get an understanding of what's happened in our world. And from that and from some other studies, some other reading, I think this is what we see if we look at our recent history. First of all, there was what we call the positive world for Christians, pre-1994. We saw significant changes in these years that we're going to look at now. And in the positive world, society at large retained mostly a positive view of Christianity. Anybody who's that old and lived in that era would probably be able to remember that. Publicly being a Christian was a status enhancer. To be known as a good church-going man or woman remained part of being an upstanding citizen. Oh, you go to church? Well, that's really good. Oh, my kids go to Sunday school? Yeah, I've got to give them, a good foundation. Christian moral norms were the basic moral norms of society, and violating them brought about negative consequences. That's what our world was pre-1994. Now, some of you weren't even born then. I can't believe that, but that's what our world used to be like, you know, in the old days, when we used to walk 3 miles to school and we used to eat stones for breakfast. You just don't know about how hard our life was. Well, actually, you don't know about how good our life was as a Christian. Some people have never experienced this, but that was what our world was. Well, the next stage we shifted into after 1994, from 1994 to 2014, is what's called the neutral world, or what I'm identifying as a neutral world, and Aaron Wren described it as this, where society took a neutral stand towards Christianity. Christianity no longer had that privileged status, but it wasn't disfavoured. It was still seen with some kind of ambivalence. Being publicly known as a Christian and neither a positive or negative impact on one's social status was still a valid option in a pluralistic society, and Christians still had a voice in the public, it's called the public square. They still had a public role to play. And Christian moral norms retained some kind of residual effect in society. People still appealed to this moral code that we find when we follow Jesus and we find in the Bible. But then we saw a significant shift from 2014 onwards. We started shifting into this negative era. Jenny and I, we were over in the States. We lived in the United States in Colorado from 2004 to 2014. We came back to Australia in 2014. And when you do something like that, you can remember what was, and you don't get the sort of gradual change. You come back and you go, oh no, what happened? What happened to our country? What happened to our place in this society? Society had become negative towards Christianity. Being known as a Christian is a social negative now, particularly in the elite domains of society, in the intelligentsia, in the academic world, in the media. Christianity is a negative. Christianity morality is expressly repudiated. It's not only just tolerated, it's repudiated and seen as a threat to the public good and the new public moral order. Subscribing to Christian moral views or disagreeing with the secular moral order brings negative consequences. I think all of you will know examples of that. And Christians no longer have a voice in the public square. So when I came back, I took up this position as Director of Ministry in Christian Community Church, in our Christian Community Church movement. And in that role, I was invited to go to heads of churches meetings. And so I was invited in that first year I was back to go to a consultation with the government, the Victorian government, in at Parliament House on Spring Street. So off I trundle in there, and there was some legislation that was being considered, which was of concern to Christian leaders. And so we went in there for a consultation to have a voice, to share what our perspective was. And heads of churches, Baptist Church, Churches of Christ, Catholic Church, Anglican Church, were all there. And I was invited. Now, our church movement's a bit different. We don't have a hierarchical leadership, but I've got identified as the person, the go-to person for Christian community churches in Australia. in Victoria in particular. So off I went. So we go in, go through all the security and everything, and then, you know, because we're very dangerous people, and they checked all our bags and stuff, and we sit down, and then the minister who was responsible for this legislation came out and talked about what the legislation was, described to us what it was going to be, and then the premier came out and said, we're going to do this. Then they left, and we left. The next day, front page of the newspaper, we consulted with the church leaders, and we are going ahead with this after consulting with the church leaders. So they didn't want to hear from us. They wanted to leverage that moment to actually say we endorse what they were doing. From then on, some other legislation came in. We collectively got together, said, this is even worse. We need to have a consultation. And they said, you're not invited. We're not going to talk to you anymore. And so we're no longer invited to even turn up. And so that is just an example of how Christians have lost the public square voice, their place in the public square. Prior to that, when I was involved in Youth for Christ, and I was often asked to go to consultations with the government, I was often asked to be part of a consultation group in working out solutions for young people. Now Christians have been uninvited from every place. So in these various stages of change, what did the evangelical church do? What we see that there was opposition. We saw things changing. So what was the strategy? Well, for the positive world, the strategy that was adopted in the 1970s was, and it was sort of in response to the sexual revolution and moral deterioration of Western societies, it was called a cultural war strategy, also known as the religious right. Now, some of you would know about the religious right. It's best known movement, that was the best known movement of the positive world era, when people thought this moral degradation, this things are changing, we've got to fight this. We've got to reclaim society for God. We've got to actually reclaim our Christian heritage in society. And the name of the organisation that was at the forefront of that, particularly in the United States, was called Moral Majority. Now, some of you might remember that term, Moral Majority, the name. And it speaks to a world which, at least it was plausible to claim that Christianity was represented by the majority of the people in society. So that's why it's called Moral Majority. We're going to speak on behalf of the people in society who align with all our Christian values, even if they don't claim to be Christian. So this movement emerged, and there were these cultural warriors who went out to combat this change and to reclaim society for Christianity. And some of the major figures in that were Jerry Falwell of Moral Majority, Pat Robinson of Christian Broadcasting Network, James Dobson, Focus on the Family, Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition, and in Australia, Reverend Fred Nile. Who remembers Reverend Fred Nile? Okay, so you know about this. And the second strategy of the positive world movement was this seeker-sensitive strategy. You might remember Bill Hybels. And in the 1970s, he set up this mega churches. And in Willow Creek was the one where Bill Hybels thrived. And it was this seeker-sensitive strategy. And Bill Hybels travelled all over the world teaching about seeker-sensitive. How do we be sensitive to the people in society? And how do we make a place for them? The term seeker-sensitive shows that it was based on or predicated on an underlying presumption that people were friendly to Christianity. And it's a model that assumes that a large number of people were actively seeking because it's seeker-sensitive. And so Bill Hybels, in trying to develop a better strategy for engaging all these people who were seeking something, seeking Christianity, He walked door to door in the suburbs of Chicago, surveying unchurched people, and he asked them why they didn't attend church. By designing a church that appealed to them stylistically, he was able to attract large numbers of these seekers. Now, this was about round about this time that I got appointed as the pastor of Notting Hill Community Church. I didn't know how to be a pastor. I was a young bloke. We'd been involved in working on an Aboriginal mission. We came back and I was put in this role at Notting Hill Community Church. I didn't know what to do, really. So I decided I would visit, I didn't know about Bill Hybels either, I decided I'd visit every house in the neighbourhood. So, knock on the door. Hi, I'm this young bloke. I'm David. I am the new pastor of the church down the road. Can I have a chat to you? Yeah, come in, have a cup of tea. Not, call the police, get off my property. Come in, have a cup of tea. I went to these houses and I had to go home and go to the toilet, you know, because I was having so many cups of tea. Because I was invited in so much. And I'd ask them, I'd actually make this simple statement. I believe the church exists to serve you. What can we do to serve you? And I got all these, oh, you know, if you want to help us, help our kids. Help our kids. You know, there's a gang in the area, they were doing all this vandalism stuff, and then the school down the road, they're having problems, and then our kids don't have a youth community to belong to, and I kept hearing this, the demographic of the area was help our kids. So, we came back and, I came back and talked to the church and said, we really need to focus on young people. We need to provide children's program, but we really need to provide something for teenagers. And we did. Ended up growing very rapidly. We had about 200 new believers because we responded to the needs in society. It's another story. We won some people in the gang over, and then the gang leader started attacking the church and smashed our church bars. And, you know, we had troubled times, you know, and the people in the church wondered why on earth they brought me on as a pastor, because it was destroying their church. But in the end, we ended up transforming the community. Now, if I go bang on the door today and say, hi, I'm David, I'm the pastor down the road, I say, get off my property, I'll call the police, would be probably more the response. Or, what are you doing here? What do you want? What do you want from me? Not, what can you do for me? Things have changed. So, we shift then into this neutral world. And the neutral world, the response of the evangelical church in the neutral world was cultural engagement. I've got to be involved culturally. The neutral world, cultural engagement, in many ways, the opposite of the cultural warriors. They didn't see society as something to fight, you know, to define themselves against society, and we've got to change this. Rather, they saw that they perceived that they should be positive towards society. They didn't denounce secular culture, but confidently engaged in the culture on its own terms and in the pluralistic public square where they still had a voice in the neutral era. They believed that Christianity could still be articulated in a compelling way and that it had something to offer everyone. In this quest, they wanted to present the secular elite media, and they wanted to be present in the secular elite media because they believed that was the place where things were being taken in the wrong direction. And so not only in Christian media, but they also found platforms in academia and in the secular media environment. Most of the urban church world and many parachurch organisations embraced this strategy. And in my Youth for Christ era, that's what we were doing. We tried to be visible in society in a positive way, engage in the culture, provide things for young people that were equivalent to what was being provided in society. You know, massive big youth loud concerts where your eardrums are, you know, I still think I'm losing my hearing because of that. And your organs are rearranged by the music. You know, that's what was appropriate. Now, the major figures in that era was Tim Keller, Redeemed Church. We all know Tim Keller, who's recently died. And then Hillsong emerged in that era. Christianity Today magazine, author Andy Crouch, they were the prominent figures of this neutral era response, cultural engagement. But then we move into the negative world. And, you know, prior to Tim Keller getting sick, he used to go and speak at many of the universities, like the prominent Stanford and Harvard and those universities. He was invited to speak. Towards the end of his life, he was cancelled from every one of those engagements because his values and what he was espousing was no longer valid or appropriate. In fact, it was seen as a great negative. And so this person who was a champion in that neutral era became an anathema in the same forums where he was formerly engaging. And so in this negative world, what do we see? What do we see that's really radically changed? Well, one of the first things is our society has changed in its demographic spread. We've seen the rise of the nuns, the nuns. No religion. For the first time really in recent history, we've got a lot of people who are saying they are of no religion at all, or other religions, or they're not even fair to claim it, more so than Christianity. So there's this emerge. In the past, when they did a census, most of the people identified as something spiritual. Now, we've got 39% of people saying they have no religion, and 7% saying it doesn't even matter to me. So I am not even going to bother to answer that question because it has no relevance. And so we're talking about 46% of people who are claiming they've got no spiritual element and no desire to have spiritual engagement. And yet, in our society, when you look at what the sociological research is showing, it's been described, not by Christians, but by sociologists, our society, our current society, as one of the most spiritual ever in history. Now, what does that mean? Well, I was trying to work out what that meant, and I thought, okay, somebody who talked a lot about spirituality on a broader sense was Kierkegaard. Now, some of you might have tried to read Kierkegaard, a philosopher. He is the father of existentialism. Existentialism is seen as the enemy of Christianity, and yet he claimed to be a Christian. So he's sort of this dilemma when you come to his stuff. Anyway, so I was trying to wade through that to get unscathed. He was probably one of the best commentators on spirituality in the broader context of humanity. And what he described was spirituality is something beyond yourself. When people start thinking constantly, there's something more than this. There's something beyond me. And this generation apparently do that more than any other generation in modern history. Now, if you want to know what society is thinking, look at the way in which people are advertising to them. The police have got this big campaign on at the moment. You're made for more than this. More than this. You see it in a whole lot of contexts. There's more to this life than this. This is the advertising. The search is Rip Curl's, main platform for selling their product, marketing their products. The search, searching for something beyond this, something better. And so we have a society that you could say is the most spiritual. Yet a society now that are claiming to have no religion. So they're spiritual, but they're not religious. This is our negative world that we find ourselves in. And so, what do we see as the characteristics of this negative world? The rise of the nuns, the loss of credibility of the church, institutional sexual abuse in the church has been largely responsible for the destruction of the church's reputation. The church collectively, the institutional church collectively failed the most vulnerable people in their communities. So much so that the society and the government had to step in and actually legislate for the church to do what they should have done, which is protect the most vulnerable. That has destroyed the credibility of the church in a very large way. So that's one of the elements that's driven this. The collective failure of prominent evangelical leaders has been another major plank in the building of this negativity. All these people who were heroes of the faith, who were very prominent, the latest casualty of that is Hillsong. Hillsong was known right across Australia, beyond the Christian world. for their music, for their success, for their school, for their, and now they've been discredited. Article after article after article, and they're still trying to recover from that, and their leader has been discredited, as have many other evangelical leaders around the world. This is another problem, another issue that has driven this negativity. Polarisation of the church. Churches stop fighting for Jesus and going out and looking beyond themselves at the outside, and they're starting to look at each other and they're fighting each other constantly. They're defining themselves against each other. There's this counter-dependency that's emerged in the church, in the institutional church. And instead of saying, we're for Jesus, we love everyone, we're about forgiveness, salvation, we say, we're not like them. We don't believe what they believe. We're better than them. And so you see this polarisation. That does not help when people are fighting each other. Now, this is all generalisations, but this is what's driven this negativity. And so we've lost our voice in the public square, which we've talked about. This church is seen as an institutional community that needs to be managed and placated rather than respected as a contributor. How do we manage the church? Well, there's quite a few people who actually like the church. We better try and manage it so we don't get too many people offside, but they're really irrelevant. Been a number of public statements made by politicians about the Bible, saying it's an irrelevant book. It's a book that actually once I won't tell who it was, said Christians need to rewrite the Bible. It's no longer valid or relevant. It's completely out of alignment with the values of our society. So there you go. You got a job, Josh. You got to rewrite the Bible so it actually aligns with what the politicians think we should believe. And then there's been this disengagement from society. So because society has changed so much, the church is disengaged rather than stepping out, keep doing the job which Nehemiah did, became more engaged. The church is withdrawn, starting to build walls. And then judgmentalism comes. So from behind the walls, Christians are saying, you're wrong, we're better, we're right, you're wrong. That's attacking this judgmentalism, we're right. And we saw that in a little bit of family conversation that we had going on social media recently, where one of our family members who isn't a practicing follower of Jesus made a statement and was attacked by one of our other family members who's very sure of their faith. And they went right after him and said, you're wrong. This is morally wrong, this is ethically wrong, you're just thinking wrong, you've got to actually readjust your thinking. And so the response was, well, what makes you the authority to say what's right and wrong? He says, the Bible says this, and starts quoting the Bible. She says, Bible has no relevance to me. What do you do with that? It's an outdated book, it has no relevance. Well, you're still wrong. So that judgmentalism, we're right, you're wrong, is not helping our cause. We're not making a case for Jesus, we're making a case for our particular understanding of the Bible. And self-righteousness is not a good strategy for evangelism. Humility is a much more effective strategy for evangelism. So if we come along as being right, everybody else is wrong, we say we're better than everybody else, that's not going to help us in this negative society. So what is the answer? How do we respond to the situation we find ourselves in? How do we keep fighting? How do we persist? How do we pursue the things that Jesus has asked us to pursue? What is the measure of our faith that Jesus said we always got to go back to? And it's fruitfulness. It's humility. It's all the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness. That's that fruit we're meant to be exhibiting in society. And fruitfulness from a perspective of sharing Jesus with others and seeing them come into a relationship with him. That's our role, to build the wall, build the kingdom. That's our role. How do we keep doing that in a society that has wholesalely rejected us? Well, I think we find a little hint in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 1 and then 11 and 12. Therefore, rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. We got rid of all this criticism, this critical spirit, this lack of humility, self-righteousness, hypocrisy. We love you, but you're wrong, and you're going to hell. I urge you, as foreigners and exiles, which we are now, to abstain from sinful desires which wage war on your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, which they do, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. So what is the strategy that we can deploy? I believe it's relational engagement. This church is pretty good at relational engagement. Since taking up the role in Christian community churches, we've got pretty much involved in helping church planters, in investing in church planters, and we've seen about 23 church plants in the last 10 years. One of the most recent ones of those was by a couple, Jim and Pinky. I think some of you know the Gorgonias, Jim and Pinky Gorgonia. They actually planted the church that we're involved in, and we were part of that church plant in the city. We meet in the building, in the CYC building in the city every Sunday, right next to Southern Cross Station. It's called Southern Cross Church. People come into the city visiting, and they type church near Southern Cross. We come up first, so we have new people all the time. And often just people who are there for a short time, just, oh, I thought I might check out a church while I'm here. We've seen quite a few new believers. Jim and Pinky started that church, but then we wanted to plant other churches from that church, and they decided that they really needed a church out in the west. People would come, they lived temporarily in the city, and they'd go out west because that's where affordable housing was. So they bought a house out at Hoppers Crossing, and they planted a church in Windenbale. So what do they do to plant a church? Well, the way we do church planting is we find church planters. They self-identify because they're already reaching people. But we don't take a congregation and put it into a place. The couple, usually a couple, maybe a few other people, go and they start engaging relationally in the community that they want to reach. And then they evangelize the church into existence. So what did they do? They went there and they moved out there, and for a year they got engaged in society. The Filipino heritage, so Pinky got involved in the Filipino community, all the social groups and that. They asked what services were going on in society and what's needed. And there was a food bank down there. There's a lot of need down there out there, where they've got their church, Windenbale. And they didn't have any volunteers to run the food bank. There's very few people who were doing it, and it was failing. And they came in and said, we'll do that. We'll run that for you. And they started running the food bank. And then they found some other Christians in the society, and they came and helped as well. And so the food bank's run by Christians. They got to know all these people in need. And then they'd ask Jim, what do you do? He said, well, my name's Jim, J-I-M-M. Jesus is my Messiah. And they go, what? What does that mean? And he explained it to them. He said, oh, we're planting a church here, you know, that's what I'm doing, and I follow Jesus. In the end, that group, all the people coming, said, we need a pastor. Jim, will you be our pastor? So Jim became the pastor of the food bank before they planted a church, before they started a church. Relational engagement, serving those in need, loving them in Jesus' name. He wasn't rejected when he said, my name's Jim. He was, oh, that's fantastic. I know you care about us because of what you're doing. We want more of this. They started the church just over a year ago, officially. Our trust renovated an old church building out there. I know for sure they've had 30 new believers. They had 19 baptisms, and they've evangelized a church into existence, and more Christians joined them, and now I think there's about 120 people. And there's quite a few people that come to their church who are not believers. They had a couple of people in their church who said, we do homeschooling because we're so worried about what's happening in our schools. And they were Christians, 5 Christian families. But we need to get our kids together. They need to have social interaction. And we need some help from you to do that. So they started gathering together on Friday. Well, those families knew all these other families who weren't believers, who were also homeschooled, and they started bringing their friends along. Said, oh, to Jim, can we bring our homeschooling friends along? So they ended up with 23 families, only five of them Christian families. So Jim was teaching them to do public speaking and that, and he would talk about the Bible. He said, this is what I do in church. And he would give us a little sermon. In the end, they said, well, we really like this, you know, can we do some music and stuff? And so they did music. And then one day Jim said, you know, this is all about Jesus. Who would like to be a follower of Jesus? All these hands went up. So now, what does he do? Did he invite them to the morning service on Sunday? He said, no, we've got a church. So he's got another community that's been evangelized into existence because he served the needs of these people. He met them at their point of need. Relational engagement is the valid strategy in a negative world, not advocacy for an institutionalized church. That's what we've got to go for. Relational engagement on people's terms. So these churches, when they emerge, are shaped around the people who they're trying to reach, rather than having a prescribed culture and saying, here we are, 30 people, we're going to have a church plant, you need to be like us, come to us. The church gets evangelized at the point of need, and it's shaped around the people. When people come to that church, Christians, and say, I want to be part of your church, Jim, this is what he says. Well, if you're looking for a church for you, this is not the church for you. This is a church for the unreached. If you're looking for a place you can come and engage with unreached people and serve them, this is a place for you. And that helps to filter out the people who are looking to institutionalize their Christianity. Anyway, there's a lot of thoughts there. There's another corollary to this that we probably need to explore sometime about what is distinctive about our faith out of all other faiths. That's something for another day. But we're out of time, so I'll close in prayer. Jesus, we have a tough gig in this world to represent you and to counter all this negativity. Lord, help us to understand and know what is the best way to show your love and grace to others. Lord, there's so many people out there who are looking for something more, and we know that you have given us that. Just help us, Lord, to serve them well. Lord, we don't want to misrepresent you. We want our people to know that they're loved and that they're welcome. Help us to find ways in which we can all be involved in that. We ask this in your name, Jesus. Amen.